listening to the Sunstone Podcast by the Sunstone Education Foundation, bringing you quality discussions surrounding Mormonism from the recorded audio from our past summer symposiums. Sunstone brings you over 40 years of engaging, thoughtful discussions around Mormonism. Check us out on iTunes under Sunstone Magazine, visit our website at sunstone.org, and join us for our many conferences and events.
Hello, everyone. We'd like to welcome you to session number 276, entitled Multiply and Replenish If You Want To, the 1999 LDS Church Birth Control Policy in Perspective. I'd like to give you a reminder that admission to all sessions is by name tag or ticket only. This session is sponsored by Planned Parenthood of Utah. And in the introduction to our guest today, we have Maxine Hanks, who will be presenting her paper today, and she is the writer and editor of Women and Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. Her book is available in the book room just down the hall. Also presenting today will be Carrie Galloway, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Association of Utah, and then comments will be presented by Rebecca Chandler, an LDS mother of eight and a co-editor of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. We expect this to be a provocative and engaging session with lively questions and answers. These three intelligent women come from different perspectives on the issue of birth control. Maxine is pro-choice but anti-pill. Carrie is pro-choice and an advocate for the pill. Rebecca calls herself one of the last of a dying breed of breeders. We look forward to seeing you and hearing from you here at our feminist session. We'll have them present our papers and give the comments, and then we'll open it up for question and answers. Again, I would like to remind the speakers when they receive a question to repeat the question again into the microphone so that it can be recorded on the tape. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks. Actually, I wouldn't call myself anti-pill. I took the pill for quite a while, but I'm a bit negative about it. I'm not pro-pill because I had a bad experience with it, with my health. First, I'd like to thank the Sunstone Foundation for sponsoring this symposium and giving us the opportunity to talk about this topic. I also want to thank three men whose work made it possible for me to pull this paper together. Men who did pioneering work on research about birth control in Mormon culture. First of all, Vern Anderson at the Associated Press, who broke the story in January 1999 about the new church policy and the new church handbook. If it hadn't been for that story, I would not have known about this new policy, and I would not have created this piece of work. Also, Lester Bush, who's been a real pioneer in researching medical issues among Mormons, and also Tim Heaton and Eric Sweden, who've done research. They saved me a lot of work, which allowed me to look at larger patterns. I've got a lot of material here, so I think I'm going to go fast. 1999 was a good year for Mormon women. For the first time in 170 years of LDS church history, birth control officially became a completely personal decision. Published in September 1998, a new LDS church policy on birth control made history, giving Mormons unprecedented freedom over their own reproductive powers. This new policy signifies a major shift in LDS authoritative rhetoric. Historically, Mormons have received strong advice from church leaders about having children, warning young couples not to delay pregnancy and emphasizing the blessings of large families. But now, church opinion on birth control is a thing of the past. In language that leaves no room for doubt, the policy in the 1998 LDS Church Handbook of Instructions places all decisions about having children entirely in the hands of couples. I'm going to evaluate the significance of this new policy by comparing it to previous church policies, and also look at it from rhetorical, historical, and personal perspectives. Then I'll also, if I have time, include some personal experiences from parents with these policies. I believe this new LDS Church birth control policy is worth publicizing and perhaps even celebrating. Why? Potentially, it frees women from a 170-year tradition of compulsory motherhood, an expectation that motherhood is mandatory. This could be the biggest change affecting Mormon women in history. From the genesis of Mormonism in 1830, women have been told that motherhood is a commandment, a divine calling, a duty. Until the 1870s, women were only addressed in 10% of church discourse, and yet the dominant focus or topic was motherhood as women's divinely mandated and primary role. After 1870, an emphasis on large families continued to be prescribed by male church leaders and reiterated by women themselves for 100 years into the 1970s. No matter what the cost or doubt was privately for these women, there was little outward resistance to having children, given the pro-motherhood rhetoric in their publications and journals, the women's publications and journals. Interestingly, there is still evidence, though, that Mormon women did use birth control all along. However, in the 1970s, Mormon women finally began to be more outwardly expressive about their doubts about expectations of motherhood, while still producing at least medium-sized families. And although birth control pills finally offered LDS women more freedom, many women report they still had more children than they wanted in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, citing that sense of duty articulated in church discourse. Clearly, church leader statements on motherhood and birth control have shaped women's and men's lives for nine generations. However, the 1998 church birth control policy is a watershed moment in church rhetoric, freeing women and men to choose for themselves whether to have children, and thus freeing them to shape their own lives. Ironically, few women have heard about this new policy. More than a year after its publication, this policy is still largely unknown. I've asked dozens of Mormon women about the new policy, and none of them have heard of it. If not for an Associated Press article in January 1999, perhaps no one would have even noticed the policy. The AP story penned by Vern Anderson was titled, LDS Handbook Says Family Size Up to Couple and God. It ran in papers across the West and drew some attention, but few people seemed to comprehend its significance as a drastic change in church policy. Even more importantly, the effects of birth control policy on personal lives is a story yet to be told. The new LDS church birth control policy is very brief. It's contained in one paragraph under the heading of birth control in the 1998 church handbook. It reads, "It is the privilege of married couples who are able to bear children to provide mortal bodies for the spirit children of God, whom they are then responsible to nurture and rear. The decision as to how many children to have and when to have them is extremely intimate and private and should be left between the couple and the Lord. Church members should not judge one another in this matter. Married couples should also understand that sexual relations within the marriage are divinely approved, not only for this purpose of procreating, but also as a means of expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds between husband and wife. This is the most lenient birth control policy in church history. It does share some elements with previous statements, yet it is a major departure in a couple of ways. For the first time, parenthood is now a privilege rather than a responsibility or a duty. This implies that parenthood itself may be an option, since a privilege is something special, uncommon. Also, all decisions about having children now belong to the couple, whose own feelings take precedence over church counsel and scriptural mandates. For the first time, any judgment by the church or its members is condemned." Two previous official church policies were published in 1989 and 1976 as entries in the church in those church handbooks. Prior to that, no church policy appeared except for a formal statement issued by the First Presidency in 1969. Prior to that, we have only individual church leaders' statements. Both the 1976 birth control policy and the 1989 policy are based upon the 1969 statement. Thus, I group the three of them together as a kind of triptych. So in terms of official policy, I look at those three plus the 1998 policy, and would say that there are four church official church policies on birth control. Prior to 69, we don't have an official policy. The 1989 policy is more traditional than the 1998. It states that husbands must be considerate of their wives, who have a great responsibility not only for bearing children, but also caring for them through childhood. Husbands should help their wives conserve their health and strength. Married couples should seek inspiration from the Lord in meeting their marital challenges and raising their children. The difference between the 89 policy and the 98 policy is striking. In 1989, women are given a great responsibility to bear children, the only limit being the conservation of the health and strength. Meanwhile, the 1976 policy, which is the one before that, is even more traditional and burdensome. It says, "We have been commanded to multiply and replenish the earth, that we may have joy and rejoicing in our posterity. Where husband and wife enjoy health and vigor and are free from impurities that would be entailed upon their posterity is contrary to the teachings of the church to artificially curtail or prevent the birth of children. Those who practice birth control will reap disappointment by and by." The 1976 and 1989 policies clearly communicate a church expectation that parents are responsible to produce children. I want to stop at this point and talk about the larger pattern that I see in some of this. First of all, we have four policies, the 69, the 76, 89, and the new one. But when I look at policy and try to analyze it from a rhetorical perspective, it's really a communication that is directed at church members. That's what policy is. But what's interesting is that it may reveal more information about those who give the policy, the church leaders, than it does about members. And it's really members' reactions to church policy that is information about them. Also, I noticed there are kind of three facets of a church policy. Anytime you have a church policy, you have sort of three aspects. There is the cause or the origin of the policy. What prompted it? Quite often it's a response to something. Then you have the policy itself or what it says. And then you have, third, its effect on members and the members' response to the policy. So anytime you talk about a church policy, I think it's important to look at all three aspects. What's interesting is that birth control policy in Mormonism all takes place in a 30-year window between 69 and 99. And this creates a very interesting moment in Mormon history when we have church leaders expressing an official policy. The first three, the 69 and the 76 and 89, are all traditional, restrictive, somewhat coercive about having children and not using birth control. And the fourth, or the current one, is not. And so I think it's really significant to notice that there is this period of time in Mormon history when church members were getting an official directive about birth control. Also, it's interesting to note that the first official statement, which was a first presidency statement in 1969 upon which the formal policy was based, that it occurs during a watershed moment for birth control, because it was in 1960 that the birth control pill makes its debut. And it's in the 1960s when birth control becomes more available and more advertised and well-known to American women and Mormon women. And thus we see in 1969 the first formal statement by the LDS Church against birth control. Okay, I'll come back to that in a little bit, and I'll go off in another direction. Lest we celebrate too soon, I want to say that what we have here in the 1998 birth control policy is not a new doctrine. It's important to note that the new birth control policy does not abandon LDS Church doctrine, which still holds the family as central to the Creator's plan. The underlying doctrine for all church statements about parenthood is the biblical mandate in Genesis to multiply and replenish the earth. However, there is a difference between doctrine and policy. Doctrine remains intact within scriptural canon, while doctrinal interpretations and policies change, sometimes drastically, with the times, with needs and personalities of leaders. In fact, the interpretation of birth control doctrine has varied widely with different church leaders and generations. Thus, interpretation and policy are open to constant change, while doctrine and theology are less flexible. I'm going to skip over a little bit because I've got too much material here. I want to give a little bit of a historical perspective just to give you an idea of how birth control policy has evolved since the turn of the century. The policy on birth control has continually evolved from complete denouncement in 1908 to partial approval in the 1960s to non-involvement in 1998. From past to present, the changes in LDS statements on birth control are illuminating. Even a brief review offers some interesting insights. In the 19th century, birth control itself was rare. The options were primitive ones: barriers, rhythm method, home remedies, or abortion. However, LDS church leaders rejected all methods. In 1908 comes the first general authority statement on birth control. This is interesting because it comes right at a time when American feminists, especially Margaret Sanger, were striving to make birth control available around the turn of the century to American women. So we see LDS church rhetoric as a form of response to a secular trend involving birth control. Church President Joseph F. Smith warned members not to prevent spirits from obtaining earthly tabernacles. "I do not hesitate to say that prevention is wrong," he advocated, although he did make allowances for weak and sickly people. Then, beginning in 1914, a consideration was allowed for the health and vigor of the parents. Now, again, I just want to emphasize, these are individual statements by church leaders, but they don't constitute church policy. So we get the first statement by a church leader in 1908, but we get the first policy in 1969. So hope that explains where I'm going with this. So I'm just kind of reviewing some of the statements that church leaders have made kind of on their own. Beginning in 1914, the consideration was made for the health and vigor of the parents, and this became the exception to birth control allowed in all church statements ever since then. Then in 1942, another consideration for financial well-being was added, likely reflecting the hard lessons of the Depression years. In 1933, Apostle J. Reuben Clark saw birth control as a personal decision, not as an institutional matter. In 1939, President Heber J. Grant wrote that healthy couples were recreant in their duty if they refused to meet the natural and rightful responsibility of parenthood. Then in 1942, Apostle John Widstow wrote, "As far as I know, the church has not expressed itself to birth control." In 1946, Apostle David O. McKay wrote that when the health of the mother demands it, the proper spacing of children may be determined. So you see the fluctuations back and forth from different church leaders, somewhat contradictory. In 1960, Apostle Hugh B. Brown said, "Latter-day Saints believe in large families wherever it is possible." Meanwhile, the church's General Handbook of Instructions in 1963 and again in 1968 made no mention whatsoever and had no entries for birth control and offered no advice on the matter. But the first formal church statement was issued in 1969. And again, I see this as a very likely as a reaction to the prevalence of birth control becoming available in the 1960s. The 1969 First Presidency Statement is the basis for subsequent policy. What's interesting is that this is a watershed moment in church policy, creating an official stand, church stand on birth control. But it's responding to a watershed moment in American women's history and birth control history, because the 1960s was a watershed decade for birth control. So I find that to be an interesting correlation. I also find it very interesting that this parallels what happened at the turn of the century, that we have a kind of a watershed time for the emergence of birth control at the turn of the century for women, and we have the very first statement made by an LDS church leader that we know of responding to birth control. So we have this parallel in 1908 and 1969 of two major pivotal church policies seeming to be reactions to secular trends. The 1969 First Presidency statement reads, "We seriously regret that there should exist a sentiment or feeling among any members of the church to curtail the birth of their children. We have been commanded to multiply and replenish the earth, where wife and husband enjoy health and vigor and are free from impurities that would be entailed upon their posterity. It is contrary to the teachings of the church artificially to curtail or prevent the birth of children. We believe those who practice birth control will reap disappointment by and by." And then it goes on to express that husband and wife should be considerate for the health of the mother. You can tell from this statement that it is echoed again in the 70s and in the 80s in the next two policies, which still use some of the wording from this statement but modify it. There were also renewed admonitions to have as many children as possible in the 1970s, coming from Spencer W. Kimball and Ezra Taft Benson. In 1976, then, we have finally a formal policy on birth control, which I've already covered. And then in 1979 came a statement in the Church Ensign quoting from the 1976 Church Handbook. This is interesting because the 1976 Church Handbook was the first handbook that actually had the policy, but it's then quoted in the Ensign where everybody can read it. So that in this way, a policy that's normally hidden in the Church Handbook of Instructions is made widely available to all church members. And it's interesting because this doesn't happen really with the other policies in the handbook. But with this policy, this very restrictive birth control policy in 76, it was published, or at least quoted in the Ensign. The 1989 handbook then again updates the birth control policy and softens it a little bit. Which brings us back again, full circle, to the new policy in 1998. And I find it interesting because just as the 1908 and 1969 statements on birth control were pivotal, sort of watershed moments, I see the 1998, the new policy, as a pivotal watershed moment. Because it's turning away from the past 100 years of restriction of birth control, and it's turning members back toward themselves. And this represents, again, a major shift. I've got so much material and no time to cover it. Since I want to talk a little bit more about the rhetoric of this policy. Since these previous policies are restrictive and responding to secular trends, this begs a very important question about the new policy. What is this new liberating 1998 birth control policy responding to? Is it responding to secular trends? I doubt it. Is it responding to church members' concerns? Probably not. Is it responding to dissatisfaction and negative fallout from the previous policies? Maybe. Is it pragmatism? Bad PR? It's hard to know who is responsible for this new birth control policy. We don't know if it was suggested by a mid-level moderate or a feminist editor, if it was a conscious improvement, or the result of correlation. Whoever's responsible, though, I would like to publicly thank them, even if it was just a typo, you know, or a case of over-editing, or just a fluke. I'm really grateful to see it happen. According to LDS Public Affairs, this policy is not really new. It's just a clarification of what's already out there. A church spokesman explained that the handbook is a compilation of policy statements and letters distributed to bishops and stake presidents. And these circulate and then are compiled, and their latest version is just the latest version. You know, I find it ironic, though, that the end of a rhetoric which consumed women's lives for 170 years is such a non-event. One would think that somebody would notice this change and at least let women know about it, but that hasn't happened. No special announcement or letter was issued, and the new policy remains anonymously tucked away on page 158 of the Official Church Handbook of Instructions for Stake Presidencies and Bishops. I'm going to skip a little bit more. It's interesting. This new policy may actually be what the church PR spokesman said that it is. It may actually be a serendipitous result of revision. It could also be a sign of maturity in the church policy making, or it could be a reflection of changing times. Maybe it doesn't matter why it happened. Ultimately, the changing policies over the last 100 years illustrate one very key point, and that is that church policy does change. Church leaders' interpretations differ, and at times refute each other. Since these policies do change, this begs some important questions. Which statement is the correct one? What if the new policy is replaced by a more constrictive one later? How should one value these statements? Should members take any statement to represent the will of God, or could they all be viewed as advice? In any case, the new policy is a significant positive change that receives praise across the spectrum from Orthodox to heretic. Now, another aspect I want to look at really quickly is response. When I talked about the three categories of policy, the third one is members' response, and I'm probably going to have to summarize quickly, but I see three categories based on my research and my interviews of women as to how member, and men, by the way, men and women on this topic, I see three categories as to how members responded to the birth control policies during this window of 1969 to 1999. And the first category is those who obeyed unquestioningly and had as many children as absolutely possible. The second category would be those who disobeyed and disregarded the policy and tried to avoid it as much as possible. The third category is those who obeyed the policy but used birth control to space their children. And I found through my own research and also in the research of Tim Heaton that this tends to be the biggest category. The majority of Mormons fall into category C, which is very interesting. Tim Heaton's statistical and quantitative analysis revealed this to be the case, and I found the same thing to be true when I interviewed women qualitatively gathering information. And I thought it was very interesting that the quantitative and the qualitative data would match up. By far, most of the women I've interviewed have said that they felt that it was understood that they needed to have children, but that it was okay to use birth control to space the children. Another aspect of member response that I want to mention is reaction or evaluation years after the fact. And I've noticed two categories of member reaction by people after they've already had their children, after it's sort of too late to go back and reevaluate it. And the two categories, of course, are predictable. There are parents who regret having had as many children as they had, and there are parents who do not regret at all and are grateful that they had as many children as they had. I'm going to try to zip through here and hit a couple of highlights. Historically, Mormon women have had two basic obvious options: either be obedient and have children, or be disobedient and risk negative judgment. A third option was less obvious, to strike a balance between the two extremes, and yet that's the option that most women have chosen. It's interesting because this is borne out through studies. In spite of the large family ideal consistently preached through the 1980s, one study found that Mormons, clear back in 1910, had an average of 4 to 5 children, and in the 1960s had an average of 4 children. Also, surveys since 1935 show a majority of Mormons supporting or using some form of contraception, and in Tim Heaton's work, he notes that by 1975, 96% of Mormons were using birth control. Yet the Mormon birth rate still remains higher than non-Mormon birth rate, which is really interesting. In fact, a third of LDS church membership growth comes from its own birth rate. And in Utah, that's even higher. As much as 50% of church growth comes from the birth rate. So it's interesting. There seems to be a very interesting and complex understanding or response to policy that is creating this third category, where members are, on the one hand, feeling obedient to the doctrine, but allowing themselves the freedom to use birth control. I wanted to take time to read some personal stories from the different categories. I have personal statements from women coming from each category, those who regret having so many children and those who don't, and why. And I'm just about out of time, so I want to just read a couple of things really quickly, a couple of sentences. This is from a woman who's explaining why she falls into that category C of women who felt that it was okay to use birth control. With very few exceptions, we all believed in spacing our children. There were always a few people who advocated letting the Lord space our children, but most of the use of the pill or other methods. To be honest, I believe we latched on to anything that supported the nearly universal belief in spacing children. Everyone I knew believed in having lots of kids, but when you were ready. The phrase, taking into account the health of the mother, seemed to give permission to use birth control. Then I'm just going to read two very quick statements. One woman who was very unhappy about having had as many children as she had. I have so many great stories here. Who regrets it? Susan Fulmer, 51, a mother of four, said, I only wanted one or two children because I was concerned about our quality of life. But church leaders said that was not important. In retrospect, I think they were wrong. I had four children. Two of them have birth disorders. And as a result, none of our children got enough quality parenting. My husband and I have both suffered stress, financial problems, and depression, feeling overburdened by this responsibility. And then I also want to share a comment from a woman who talked about why she was glad she did have more children than she might have. I interviewed a state president's wife who said, yes, we had more children than we probably would have due to the church's policy to have as many children as you could. But she said, I'm so grateful that I had the five children that I have because they're such wonderful people. I can't imagine life without them. And if I had been left to my own choice, I would have only had two. And I thought that was a really powerful statement. There are many women in her category. I have no quantitative data to say what percentage of Mormons fall into those categories. I simply know that from my research, those three categories do exist. And they're all very powerful, compelling stories. And my final comment here to wrap up is simply that relying too much on a church policy or a church leader's advice can leave us disillusioned or even bitter. Because we live in a shifting tide of opinion, both sacred and secular, this is compelling reason to claim responsibility for our own decisions. The new LDS church birth control policy is not only the most lenient in history, it may be the most wise. It honors men and women by deferring to their personal agency and respecting their own wisdom. It leaves final authority with the individual. The new policy seems to recognize that no matter what advice one may receive, each of us will have to live with our own choices. This policy is a positive change, and I think that the LDS Church should be commended for it, for doing the right thing. After some of the harm done by previous policies, this new policy can only help. Meanwhile, I recognize the danger of spreading good news. The last thing I want is to alert the church to an accidental benefit or excess of personal freedom. I don't want to inspire a negative reaction or backlash to this new policy. So let me say here and now that I think the church was inspired in this policy. No matter how it transpired, I know this policy is true. I have a testimony of it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity in having a chance to speak at the Sunstone Symposium. It's rather auspicious, and I'm a little nervous. But the topic is extremely exciting for me, being the director of Planned Parenthood for Utah. But before I get into that, I'd like to say something personally about birth control policies. My church, it's very easy. It's very clear. You don't do it. You don't do it at all. I was raised Catholic, and it was just a very clear policy that artificial contraception was wrong. You didn't care about the vigor of anyone. You didn't care about the health of anyone. It was wrong. Again, as a member of the church, you dealt with the same struggle of obedience or noncompliance as Maxine spoke about, but you didn't wonder where the policy is going. It's been very clear and very stagnant for a very long time. I can remember as a teenager when the pill first came out, and I'm the oldest of six children, and very happy, having just spent a month with my family, to have those siblings and their children in a large family to interact with. But I can remember my grandmother's reaction to my mother after having five children, using the pill for spacing, and just sure that any evil that befell my mother was the cause of that pill. So there's a lot of feeling and sensation. History, for some of us current, for some of us stories that surround use of contraception. I was fascinated when Maxine stated the church policy, but then the aside was that women did what women had to do. And I noticed so many smiles in the audience from the women. I'm sorry, men, I didn't notice you. But women from the beginning of time, as well as men, have known that control of fertility builds stronger families, stronger communities, if you can have spacing of your children. And as Maxine spoke about, most of the people that she interviewed fell into that category, that third category of spacing, and that's the majority of the women worldwide who use contraception, is for spacing of children. It's a small percentage who choose not to have children, but the majority is done for spacing. If you look back for a little historical perspective, some of our earliest methods of contraception were those leather or parchment condoms that were used from the beginning of time. Or IUDs were buttons or pebbles inserted in the uterus. Diaphragms were a half a lemon or a half of pomegranate, because that they knew that the reaction of the fruit with the vaginal fluids provided some sort of contraceptive method as well as a barrier. So we've had some incredible, ingenious methods of contraception over time, because the spacing of our families has been so incredibly important to women, who are the ones who bear children and do care for them in the majority of cases, and the men who love them. And so it has, the history of contraception, though modern contraception would be the pill, 40 years old this year, contraception over time has a very long and somewhat curious history when you start looking into it as far as methods that were used. I think that there's an aspect of the medicine of contraception, there's the aspect of the use of contraception, and there's also the psychological issues of contraception that play into our moral upbringing and usually our religious teachings on contraception. A number of social scientists have written about the use of contraception, when it works, when it doesn't work, who chooses to contracept, who doesn't choose to contracept. And unfortunately, not just within the Catholic community or the Mormon community, but the United States community as a whole, we have some conflicting values about who can have sex with whom, when, where, and why, and what should result from that act of intercourse. And one thing that happens is that if people are using contraception, they are planning to have sex. They are planning to have sex for the enjoyment of sex and not procreation. That brings up a lot of emotions for a lot of people because of how they were raised, how they were taught religiously or in other moral contexts for the reasons that we have intercourse. And I think that the use of deliberate use of contraception, declaring that sex is being used for pleasure as opposed to procreation, has been difficult for a lot of people over time in society. In fact, it's been looked at a few times in different scenarios for women, the idea of being swept away. That if sex just happens, I wasn't planning on it, but I got pregnant, it's almost a little bit more okay than for the woman who knew that she might be having intercourse, planned with contraception, and therefore is not going to get pregnant. Her promiscuity often is termed in very unflattering terms. And so when we look at how we approach our own sexuality as women and how we plan for the fact that if we're going to have intercourse, that it could result in a pregnancy, and what we do to prevent or not to prevent that pregnancy, has a lot of bearing on our self-esteem, how we look at ourselves and how we perceive that others look at us. When the new policy came out, I was called by the press to react to it. And I've been taught over the years that I don't just react. I have to think very carefully, measure my words. I see some people in the audience waiting because, again, the emotions around contraception for so many people have not been resolved. In this country, just under 50% of all pregnancies are unintended. That does not mean they're unwanted. We talked about, you know, the difference in people mistiming a pregnancy, and it's the most wonderful thing that could happen to them. But they were unintended, meaning when they had intercourse, the intention was not to get pregnant. So almost 50% of pregnancies are unintended. That's adult women, that's married women, that's across the socioeconomic perspective. It's all women. We're somewhat conflicted about how we practice family planning and engage in sexual intercourse. And as a society, I think that the new policy of the church, again, I probably hold some of Maxine's worries that if you put it on a billboard, it might backfire on you. But the idea is that if that information is out there for people, they can start thinking differently about what family planning is all about. To me, there's nothing more moral than planning your family. Knowing the number of young people that you as a husband and wife can support and care for and nurture and make sure you all make it through with your sanity at the other end of it. I know my limits too. Someday my limits won, and I don't tell which child that, you know, pushed me over the edge. Usually I blame it on the dog or my husband. But, you know, for all of us, there could be nothing more moral than planning your families And contraception is key to that, no matter what method that you may choose. I think one of the things that I think is so critical about the new church policy is that it allows that the decision to use contraception is between the man and the woman and their God. And they've left that decision to the spirituality of their church, the relationship between the husband and the wife, and knowing that there are methods available to be able to plan your family. You've got your natural family planning. Should you choose not to have what many consider to be an artificial method of contraception? Because whatever method of contraception is chosen, it has to fit with your lifestyle. It has to fit what's comfortable for you. Here in Utah, Planned Parenthood, as a healthcare organization in providing family planning services to people throughout Utah, sees between 20 and 25,000 people a year for family planning services, whether it be contraception or also sexually transmitted diseases, which we look at as preserving the fertility of people, because unfortunately, many of our sexually transmitted diseases can have a negative effect on future fertility. But we see 20 to 25,000 people a year for those healthcare services. We probably hear from over 500 people a month on our Facts of Lifeline that's in Spanish and English throughout the state with an 800 number. People have an incredible number of questions about sex and contraception and are not sure where to turn. And by having this type of anonymous information, it gives them enough words and ideas to be able to call a real person and ask a question. One of the most rewarding parts of my job is to spend time in health centers answering the phone. And more often than not, you've got someone on the other end of the line concerned about a sexuality issue, and they start out, I don't know what I should say here, and then they go into it, or it's so difficult for people to discuss contraception and sexuality. And again, I think that the new policy opens the door to have some discussion, a level playing field to be able to talk about family planning. And I guess that's why I was so delighted when the new policy was stated in the way that it was. With our time here, I want to make sure that Rebecca has time to respond and then any questions. Some of the issues having to do with methods of contraception, and Maxine started on this, and I guess I want to acknowledge it coming from an organization that promotes methods of contraception for family planning, is the realization that not all methods are for everyone. And that's why we're fortunate to have the few methods that we have. Other countries may have more. We have at least enough to get us by, and a few more coming out over the next 5 years. But for every positive story about contraception, I know, as Maxine alluded to, that people have had problems with contraception. And I guess I want to make sure that before I leave, in deference to my profession, in that we want to make sure that there is a range of methods of contraception available to people, and so that the right one can be found for them. And it's one of those issues that we go back to how conflicted this country is in contraception and the money we devote to methods of contraception and to new research, in that very little is happening on the contraceptive front in research. And it's the politicalization of reproductive health. And that's unfortunate. because though we have a variety, we don't have enough. And so thank you for your interest in reproduction.
Well, all right, I respond from the perspective of a mother of eight children, and you would think I wouldn't have much in common with someone like Maxine, who's done the research that she's done, or the president of Planned Parenthood of the state of Utah. But we actually have a lot of common ground, and I've really enjoyed both of these presentations very, very much. I've certainly enjoyed meeting Carrie for the first time and applaud her work. I heard Maxine give this paper in Southern California. It was a little different version of the paper. And so I'm responding in part to my memories of the first paper that she gave. First, I would like to commend her for her research, because I think this is an area that's very misunderstood. There's all kinds of misinformation, and as both have mentioned, all kinds of emotional overlay, a difficult subject to talk about. It's nice to just kind of have things lined up and to have a nice chronological display of what has been church policy, what has been church myth, what has been statements, who made those statements, when they were made. And then she's tried to make some kind of sense of when they were made and some historical context for those. And I'm also indebted to her for identifying the window when all of this rhetoric takes place, which happens to be the exact window of my reproductive years. So I'm also responding from someone who heard all of that rhetoric and who had to deal with it in her own life personally. I also applaud the trend, and I also completely support the new policy and celebrate it, and I'm very grateful for it. And it's, I think, a good example of a time when the church policies finally match what we've been doing all along. And now we can just point to them with pride and say, you know, obviously this is the sensible approach for us to take. I'm happy to see sexuality divorced from reproduction for the first time. Parenthood is a privilege. But there are other reasons for married couples to enjoy their sexuality, and for a long, long time we were really told that the primary purpose of sexuality was procreation, and there was all this concern about whether we were enjoying ourselves too much, and it's kind of nice to get that out of the picture. I'm really grateful for the work of Planned Parenthood, and I can see what a really good experience it would be for someone to go to someone like Carrie and get the kind of help they need and get the questions they need answered, and so I'm grateful for that. I'm also grateful to learn that half of the pregnancies in the United States are unintended. I didn't know that. I also didn't know that I was right in the middle of that statistic. Half of my children were unintended. And I, you know, didn't know what to make of that, but now I know I'm just sort of following a national trend. Someone once put her arm around me when she found out how large my family was, and she said, "Catholic, dear?" And I said, "No, just careless." I didn't know how else to explain it. In an earlier version of Maxine's paper, she talked about the fact that this statement is in the handbook, but nobody knows about it. And she was very concerned about the fact that there is a handbook to which members of the church are held, but the contents of it are not available to us. And I share her concern about that. Although I do believe that the handbook is available on a website. Do you know anything about that? Somebody who is equally outraged by the fact that the handbook is this secret document that is unavailable, especially to women, has just put it on a website. I don't know where to find it, but I know if you really want to and you poke around a little bit in the internet, it's available. I had a bishop once who had no concerns about the fact that he was supposed to be keeping this secret, and he just gave it to me. And so I read it one night, and most of it was really boring. It had to do with what color form you submit for, you know, welfare or something. So most of it in there really isn't all that interesting. I think there is a concern that there's a handbook out there that a lot of people, and especially women, don't have access to. Whether the new policy is deliberately being kept from people is a speculation I really don't share. I think the nature of the handbook is not to publish the changes in it, and this is no exception. I also didn't find the old policy quite as repressive as many others evidently did, and as Maxine certainly does. And I certainly didn't take it as seriously as many did. And I think it's important to notice that many churches, maybe most churches, most faith communities feel a need to say something about this intimate aspect of people's lives. We're certainly not the only one. I live in Shaker Heights, Ohio. You know what the Shaker's policy on birth control was? They believed in absolute celibacy. You know what happened to the Shakers? They're all dead. Most churches, for their own self-perpetuation, have figured out that if they encourage fertility, it helps the common good. It helps the cause. And it's very, very rare to find any faith community that proposes anything that restricts birth. I do know some examples of Protestant churches, kind of during this period of time we're talking about, I think, who advocated what they called responsible parenthood. And they may have been trying to position themselves against the Catholic, as Protestants so often did in many ways, and really encouraged people to have smaller families that they could responsibly raise, and implied that anyone who had a big family was being irresponsible. But for the most part, faith communities have encouraged reproduction, and that's not that surprising, really. I also had Catholic friends who really were struggling much, much more with the policy of that church than I was with mine. And I was able to say, you know, it's not so much that they're telling us we can't use birth control. It's a more positive, we value families. And I also saw my Catholic friends' reaction to pregnancies that were unintended, which were often embarrassment. You know, we got caught. We went on vacation, and something happened to my cycle, and we got caught. We get caught every summer. Oh, no. What am I going to do? And I never felt that I had to deal with that kind of thing. I felt more that we were encouraging families and that it was more of a positive, even though it was certainly encouraging families. And certainly, as a church, we are so family-oriented. I think that's another issue for people who don't have families, who don't want families, for people who are single. I don't like the whole family emphasis when it winds up ruling people out. But it did feel more positive to me than other policies might have. Let me just see what else I wrote down here. My generation, okay, is a BYU student in the late 60s and the early 70s contemplating marriage, and we all were. I do remember six-stake firesides, religion classes, ward programs, dormitory programs. I don't remember anything in general conference. But I do remember the rhetoric, even though this was pre-1969, and many of these people would cite statements from earlier general authorities back in the agrarian West, back when having a big family was a big advantage. And I agree with Maxine. I think it had to do with the fact that the birth control pill had suddenly become available, and suddenly they were probably getting a lot of questions, though, and they felt the need to respond to those. The message was clear, and we were trusting. But I don't think we all just swallowed it hook, line, and sinker and felt that that was what we had to do. We certainly talked about it a lot. And I think it led to jump-starting some families. But once people get around to what the realities of family life are, they start thinking a little differently than they might have thought back in the hazy glow of, oh, we're in love, oh, we're going to do everything the Lord wants us to do, and this will mean we'll have a whole bunch of kids. Other factors that that were concurrent with that period that I really think are worth considering, the Vietnam War. I don't know how many of you went through that period when your draft status or the status of the young man you were dating were the key factors in whether or not your relationship was going to progress. You know, you'd ask, is he cute? What's his major? What's his draft status? And once that was ironed out, a lot of young men were able to avoid service in Vietnam if they were married. I think a lot of us married sooner for that reason, and then many got that father's deferment, and my first son was born sooner than he probably would have been because it kept his father out of the war, and he has plenty of company. And those of you who are in that generation might ask your parents why they had you when they had you, and you might find that there was a political reason for that. I think there was a feminist movement backlash that I've noted in my generation also. For the first time, we were being told that we had all these possibilities and all these things that we might do. And we hadn't really been raised to do those. We had been raised to have lives very much like our mothers. And I've noticed that there was sort of a super mom
syndrome backlash that characterized a lot of women that I went to high school with, a lot of women in my age group in other wards, other places that I've met them, who raised very big families and were very, very proud of that and did it very, very well because they weren't doing other things. And that was the rhetoric they were responding to more than the have children rhetoric. They were being mothers, but they were really doing it with a vengeance, and it was because they weren't doing other things. My mother's generation never had the pressure to have a large family. My daughter's generations do not. It was really our generation that was targeted in that way. I think it's important also to notice that the birth rate is always influenced by social and demographic factors. Over time, you can superimpose the Mormon birth rate against the national birth rate and note trends. We're ahead of it, but you will note a dip in the 1930s. You'll note a jump after World War II. Then there's another dip when the baby boom levels off, another jump because the baby boom is now reproducing. It's also influenced, I think, by place. Babies are more commonly born in the Mountain West, and people stand up and cheer when people announce a pregnancy. In the East, maybe not as much. And my sister had her family in Provo, and she just, it was more fun for her to keep getting pregnant because people kept saying, good for you. And I had to have people say, oh my gosh, how many will that make? I just got back from Europe. My husband is spending the year there, and we've spent a lot of time in Northern Europe this year. And I've had a chance to visit a lot of wards. The birth rate among Mormons that we met very closely parallels the national average there, which is very, very low. One or two children. Very few exceptions to that. I know that in Asia there are many restrictive birth control policies, many of them needed for population control, and I have never heard of church leaders encouraging church members in those areas of the world to buck that trend. And when I did question one young man about it, he said, well, we're told, they invoke the 12th article of faith, obey, honor, and sustain the law. So I don't think we can really argue that the advocacy from our leaders has encouraged us sometimes to go against national norms and both demographically and over time. Last year, Marian Corwall presented her research on contemporary Utah Mormon women, not necessarily Mormon women. She cited educational factors. She mentioned their working patterns. And she said that what she could tell was that in Utah, women tended to have one more child, not three times as many children, not twice as many children. And if the national birth rate is two, is it? Okay, and one more child is three, that's a significant difference. But it's not as if we're all having eight and nine children. The last factor I'd like to cite is the intangible one, and the one that I will call the want factor. Elizabeth Whalen, maybe some of you remember her, was a journalist in the 1970s who wrote a book called A Baby Maybe. She had married a little bit later in her life than her mother and her aunts had, because she'd been enjoying her career. And they began putting pressure on her almost as soon as she announced her engagement. When were they going to start their family? And she wasn't really sure she even wanted to do that. But it made her curious why there was this assumption that once she was getting married, she would immediately want to start having a family. In fact, her mother had said to her, you're no spring chicken. You're going to need to get started right away. And so it led to a year of research where she interviewed all kinds of people from all kinds of cultures, all kinds of religions, to see what their attitudes were about this and see where the pressures, the subtle ones and the not-so-subtle ones, were coming from. And then she published this book, A Baby Maybe. But she didn't answer the question. You had to, read through the book and then say, well, what did you decide? But she left it open-ended. She wanted to help people examine their own dilemma and then let them make their own decision. And about a year later, I read in Newsweek that Elizabeth Whalen had given birth to a little girl. And when someone asked her why, she said, I wanted to. And when you get right down to it, the want factor supersedes a lot of other things. I have always wanted a family. I grew up with one brother and one sister, and I thought it was a drag. My sister was 18 months younger than I was. My brother was 9 years younger. He was more of a family pet than a sibling. I had friends that came from bigger families. I noticed their social skills. I noticed how much fun they had. I noticed that they had brothers, and so they weren't scared of boys. I noticed that the brothers sometimes led to boyfriends. It just seemed like a lot more fun than the way I was growing up. And I have asked myself, was I programmed? Was I brainwashed? Was I responding to the 50s, which was also nationally sort of a women grow up and have families period of time? And I really don't think so. I don't know how to account for it. But something that's instructive to me is to compare my own experience with my sister-in-law, who grew up exactly when I did. We're the very same age. We grew up in neighborhoods about 3 miles apart. We went to rival high schools, but they really were very similar. And I got married and had 8 children, and she married for the first time at 47, pretty safely out of the childbearing years. She didn't want children at all. Once we compared our Treasures of Truth books, and they were almost identical. We were in the same activities. We did a lot of the same things, with one notable difference. She hated dolls. She never played with dolls. I loved my dolls. I still have my dolls. It's embarrassing to admit this, but it's true. And I was very proud of being the best babysitter in the neighborhood. I really enjoyed little kids. I started teaching primary when I was 11 because they had some problem with primary graduation that year. I asked her about that once, and she said, I don't want to take care of anybody else's brats. It was a mindset that was just sort of hardwired into her and somehow was hardwired into me. And when I look back on my experience, even though I did not have quite the family I planned on having, and I acquired 2 of my children, I don't know if it was the easy way or the hard way. I married their father. And the challenges in my experience raising children was really that I was also a stepmother. And also that I worked all the time because my husband and I are both teachers. I find little to regret. I have really enjoyed my children. They're all grown up now. The youngest one goes to college in like 2 weeks, and that will bring the end of 33 years of raising children. But I don't regret any of this. I'm not feeling like, oh, empty nest, what am I going to do? I'm looking forward to the next stage of my life. But I'm proud and happy of my children. I have a very hard time imagining anything that would have given me more daily pleasure or more lasting satisfaction. So I guess I fit into that third category, second category? The category of women who aren't sorry that they had the families that they did. But I insist I was not responding to the general authorities. They tried to get me to do genealogy, didn't succeed. They're always trying to get me to do missionary work, never works. I don't know why this one found resonance, but it did. I think we all know huge families that are out of control, and our assumption is that if these people would just control their fertility, then they could control their lives. I'm learning not to judge families like this. I've noticed that sometimes families work through stages, seasons in their lives, and they have a very hard time for a little while, but they do better later on. I think we wind up coming back to the common ground that's actually inherent in the policy that Maxine cited. Parenthood is a privilege. It is a very, very personal decision. And I'm very, very grateful to have that decision affirmed in our church. And I'm very grateful for the privilege I've had of being a parent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maxine and Carrie and Rebecca. We'd like to now open it up to questions from the audience. And we'll have whoever you ask the question to, could we have you restate the question so that it can be recorded on the tape?
Nadine?
Is this on? Oh, it is. Oh, then people heard everything we said earlier. Golly. The question, as I heard it, was, does the new church policy prompt me to talk to Mormon women in a different way? First, they very seldom let me talk to any real women. I'm a paper pusher. I'm an administrator, and I really have to work to answer the phone. But probably the most important aspect of that question is I, or most of the people who work for Planned Parenthood, would have no way of knowing a person's chosen religion unless they told us. It's not a demographic that we ask. We find that in our Utah Valley Clinic, more often we may know that, just because of the demographics of Utah Valley. And more often than not, we are seeing after she's had a number of children and wanting to now have some birth control for family planning. But in the majority of our health centers, it's a wide range of people who come to us, and we don't usually know the religion. To be more to be perfectly honest, it is in public affairs and public relations that we are caused probably more often than not to raise the issue.
Well, but we agreed not to. That was part of our agreement here.
Yeah, the premise of my paper and of the panel was that it's focused just on birth control because birth control is such a huge topic. And the question that just came from the audience was, I didn't hear anything about abortion in this session. But my paper is focused on birth control and yeah, it is, and elsewhere I've done work on that topic, actually. Quite a bit of work on the topic of abortion, and you see the same pattern, but we didn't want to, the topic of birth control is so huge, we wanted to just stay focused on that for this particular presentation. Mm-hmm. Okay, back there, yeah, you. Right, was that the Lynn Wardle, that family conference that Lynn coordinated? Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know if Lynn
yeah.
Was doing it, but it was
well, we're too different. Okay.
And, yeah. And
so your question, you said you had a question around this?
Well, my question is that
the problem. Okay, I'm not sure if I've got your premise, but let me see if I've got it. You're noticing that the new policy is sending a very different message than this conference that the church is sponsoring. And did you notice the conference that the church participated or sponsored? You mentioned it was sort of anti-abortion, but did you get a sense it was anti-birth control or discouraging of birth control?
Oh, yeah. I was there. I heard all of it. I heard everything.
Well, that's very interesting. To respond to your question asking why the church would sponsor a conference that is sort of anti-birth control and yet have an official policy that is definitely supportive of birth control. I don't know that I'm prepared to resolve the church's conflicts. But I think that's just simply an indication, a kind of a byproduct, a symptom of what we've seen all along, where there are contradictory statements by different church leaders. And it's very possible for the church to be promoting a particular position that might be speaking one way, like you said, for political reasons, in order to align with other conservative religious groups, whereas, you know, doctrinally or policy-wise, the church may actually have a far more liberal perspective. I don't know, Rebecca, do you want to respond to that, too?
I think as a church, we're likely to always be pro-family, whatever that winds up meaning. And I don't. Actually, I think one of the things that I am troubled by with this whole birth control issue is not how many you children have, but the people who don't want children at all, I think, are always going to feel out of step in our church. And I think there's always the questions people ask, wonder why they don't have any children. Because we do expect people to get married and have children. I think we're getting a lot better about how many. But for reasons I tried to mention, I think a church is always going to try to self-perpetuate, and I think ours, you mentioned the growth statistics. I think we're always going to be more comfortable with a position that has people safely married and having children than any of these other variations that seem to be coming up right now.
Plus, the new policy has not really gotten out there yet, hasn't caught up yet. Most people don't even know about it yet.
You can go spread the word.
Yeah, so the people planning the conference didn't know about the new policy. Marion, do you have a... And then I'll get
on. Just responding to that, not in Mexico.
But don't you think this is a collision course that will self-correct? Don't you think this will become apparent? I think one of the reasons... Then to convert people. Now, that's true, but I noticed that the rhetoric sort of stopped when the economic realities were such that you really couldn't. That we were encouraged to get married now, have children now, and you could do it. You could go to school, you could pay your way through school and still have your family. That's just really not true anymore. And I think that's been acknowledged, and that, you know, kids are not being encouraged to jump into family responsibilities while they're still in school the way we were. And I think there's an acknowledgement of that reality. And I don't share your fear that it's going to be a complete disaster before somebody recognizes it. I think it's going. They'll see it coming.
Well, just to reiterate what the question Marion was raising, she was saying that she sees a kind of a clash between the way that Mormons have been socialized to have large families, and yet the realities of contemporary life clashing with that. And I think I share your concern, Marian, to some extent, although I also see the kind of self-correcting mechanisms that are in place that Rebecca's pointing out. You know, church leaders are telling people and have been telling young people for the last at least 10 to 15 years, make sure that you can have the number of children that you can reasonably support within your means. But I do think that there's a psychological factor here that Mormons have been raised with, that large families are good or better. And so where I see that clash is the kind of psychological perspective that Mormons are carrying and then dealing with the realities of contemporary life. Read them again just without my interpretation. Okay. Hey, John Charles wants me to read the 98 policy again. Now I'll find it here. It is the privilege of married couples who are able to bear children to provide mortal bodies for the spirit children of God, whom they are then responsible to nurture and rear. The decision as to how many children to have and when to have them is extremely intimate and private and should be left between the couple and the Lord. Church members should not judge one another in this matter. Married couples should also understand that sexual relations within marriage are divinely approved, not only for this purpose of procreating, but also as a means of expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds between husband and wife. Right, right. Well, John Charles has raised two good points, and these have been raised before, that the word privilege in the new policy, you know, might actually be there to not offend those who can't have children, rather than as permission to not have any. And also, John Charles just raised the point that the new policy tells couples that they're free to decide how many children, but that doesn't necessarily imply no children. And the way I respond to your comments is that definitely the word privilege, I sense that it was a very cautious, carefully selected word, and I think it was selected to sort of do all sorts of things at once. But on the other hand, when I take that sentence along with all the other sentences, I notice that every single sentence of this policy is incredibly liberating, validating, right down to the fact that church members are not to judge one another in this matter. Well, that includes general authorities not judging you. Also, my response to your comment about that it says parents are free to choose how many, and I agree that doesn't necessarily mean you don't have to have any, but just the fact that this is a privilege, it's a private matter that church members are not to register any judgment on, and that the parents are free to choose how many, implies that it's a completely private decision, which implies that if a couple decides not to have children, that's a private decision. And deciding the number, well, a number would mean anything from 0 to 20. 0 is still a number. So that's how I respond. Nadine, do you have? Yeah, sure.
I'll first say that half of my four children were unintended. And I just have to respond to your question. I suspect that people in your generation might have a different reaction to this policy. My childbearing years were the same as Rebecca's. And this, to me, sounds like an incredibly liberating policy after going through my childbearing years when it was a duty and it was we were going to reap disappointment by and by, and it was wrong to artificially curtail the birth of children. I mean, I took church leaders seriously, and I know that a lot of people didn't, and I think a lot of times the people who come to Sunstone are the ones who at one time took everything very seriously and then maybe had some changes in our minds later. But Maxine raised the question of how did this policy come about? And I don't know, but I suspect that it came from President Hinckley, because in the 1980s, he gave a talk at a fireside at BYU where he sort of said that it was up to the couple. It wasn't quite as explicit as what we're seeing now in the handbook, but it was really, I thought, quite freeing from some of the prior rhetoric. And then at the time, he was sort of de facto president of the church. He didn't have the office, but President Kimball or Benson, whoever it was not really functioning. And so he was kind of the head guy. And then when he was on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace asked him about large families, and his response very quickly was, "We don't tell people how many children to have." And so I think it's been moving in this direction, and I do see his hand in it, and so I hope that it's going to stay there when he's not there anymore. But I think it's a really important policy.
Thank you, Nadine. Oh, one time for one more question? Okay, I guess you in the red shirt. Couple more, okay, you in the red, and then I'll come back to you. I'm sorry, I keep...
I just wanted to make a comment about the bishop in my ward who was put in last fall, shortly after the new handbook was published. And he held, you know, in many wards on the fifth Sunday, they bring the priesthood and the Relief Society together, and they do some sort of thing with all of us together. So he had us all in the chapel, and he had the handbook up there, and he said, "All right, I've got the brand new handbook, and anybody can ask any question that they want." Well, you know, we were all so dumb. We didn't even know really what was in the handbook. I mean, it didn't occur to us to ask if transsexuals could be ordained to the priesthood or baptized. Some of these policies are very arcane. But it was a very liberating experience. Finally, he had to just say, "Okay, if you can't ask the questions, I'm just going to read to you from this." And that's in our ward when the birth control policy was published. And I appreciated it a great deal.
Thanks for sharing that, Vicki. Okay, another question.
Well, I appreciate the panel, and I'm excited to know that this is the new policy. My question to you is, young people look to their church to know the will of God. At least that's the way I thought it worked, and I appreciate your Catholics. But nowadays, it doesn't seem like the kids are reading the Word of God, so they are going to look to the church. And I'm afraid that this new policy is promoting way smaller families. And in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, it won't be popular to have a family. And I have 7 children, and it's not easy to be a mother, I'm the first to say. But I would hate to throw away the joy that I've had now, and I think the Lord knows best, and His Word has told us what to do.
Thanks for your comment. I'll respond quickly, and then I thought I'd let Carrie respond. It's interesting because the average number of children in a Mormon family has not varied too much trying to remember, the 20s or 30s, it's been an average of 4, according to the material I've found, and I want to do more research on that, and there aren't really good, reliable statistics out there, but the material I have found says that the average is 4, so that kind of lets you know that... And it may be kind of hovering between 3 and 4 right now. Carrie, do you want to respond to what she said at all?
I'll save time. I get very conflicted in this because I started out saying that I'm the oldest of 6 children, and I wouldn't change that for anything. I couldn't have had 6 children, even if I didn't have a career. Rebecca used the term hardwired. I have all the dolls still, and teaching was my profession, and children are my love. But I don't think I could have done it the way my mother did it. That, to me, is the beautiful part of what